October is, of course, a festive month known for festive days and holidays. Halloween, if perhaps you celebrate Halloween, is a big one. And we had Columbus Day, right? And if you're really into things, into the church, there's always Reformation Day. For that day that celebrates Martin Luther nailing that 95 theses to the door that began the Protestant Reformation. But there's another one that maybe you're not too familiar with, or maybe not even too excited about it. I don't know. If you're a New Yorker, you're probably not. But in October 13th, we just celebrated 62 years since that bright, sunny, warm Thursday afternoon when the Pirates beat the New York Yankees in the seventh game of the World Series. Glad Mike Gallo's not here. Well, I'm not glad he's not here, but if he were here, he'd be cringing because he was from New York. He remembers that day well. And there, yeah, Jason. I saw Jason. He just he cringed a little bit there. A home run was hit by a guy in the bottom of the ninth inning. He was a guy, 24 years old. It was his first season. He wasn't even known for hitting home runs. He was known for his fantastic glove at second base. He only hit 10 home runs all year. Bill Mazeroski. I was only 2 when that happened. I don't remember it, but it wasn't long before I heard the stories of family and friends and hear it quite often. I loved to hear Bob Fleming talk about it. Bob lived in the city, and his mom was down there in Oakland that day, and Bob would often tell us what that day was like in Oakland in 1960. It's been called the most dramatic home run in World Series history. And even if you're not a sports fan, you really are drawn to the story. I mean, you love the story. You got to love the story. It's about, of course, the Pittsburgh Pirates, who were huge underdogs. They had not won a championship since 1925. They were, again, the laughingstock of everybody. Hollywood even made a movie called Angels in the Outfield that mocked the losing Pirates. The Yankees in that series outscored the Pirates 55-27. Now, the Yankees were a force. I mean, who hasn't heard of Mickey Mantle, Roger Maris, Yogi Berra, right? Bobby Richardson was the second baseman for the Yankees, and even though the Yankees didn't win the series, he got the MVP of the series, which was very unusual. Well, when we come to that Thursday afternoon, October the 13th, 1960, the final game, the deciding game, Game 7, the Pirates get off to an early lead after 2 innings. It's 4-0. The fifth inning, the Yankees have a home run and score some runs, and now in the fifth inning, it's 4-2, Pirates. Well, then Yogi Berra comes up to the plate. He hits a 3-run home run. 2 more runs are scored, and by the time we get to the bottom of the eighth, the Pirates are losing 7-4. In that bottom of the eighth inning, something amazing happened. A ground ball was hit to the shortstop, I believe, Tony Kubik, and it should have been a double play. Should have been. I always look there to check all my facts. Theological, historical, I look for the nod right there to make sure I got it. Tony Kubik, it should have been an easy double play. The ball hits a rock and hits him in the throat. And so there's nobody out now, and he has to be carried off the field because he has his vocal cords were seriously damaged. Well, the Pirates now score and go into the top of the ninth, 9-7 ahead. They only need 3 outs. three outs to win. But in the top of the ninth, the Yankees score two more. And now we go to the bottom of the ninth. It's 9-9. And Bill Mazeroski is the leadoff hitter. And of course, the rest you know. He hits the ball over that brick wall and into Schenley Park. And it's been a part of history. What an ending, right? Unforgettable ending. And there are endings like that. I'm sure that you can think of them in all sports where the horse in the Kentucky Derby takes off and comes from behind, or a car in NASCAR, perhaps a track and field runner. We call them, what, photo finishes, right? What an ending that day in Pittsburgh. Well, in 2 Timothy, we have what many believe to be the ending for the Apostle Paul. The finish line. It's all coming to a close. And Paul now is in Rome. He's in prison for the second time. You remember in Acts 28, he's imprisoned. That was a house imprisonment. But now this is much more serious. He's in a prison. It's not a good one. And he is waiting to be executed by Nero. And he knows it, right? Because he says, "For I am ready. I am already being poured out as a drink offering, and the time of my departure has come. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Henceforth, there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness." And much could be said, and much has been said about Paul. He is finishing the race. He is finishing the course, and he is doing it well. Here is a man that has been persecuted, that has endured losses, and has paid the price of serving Christ. But I want to draw your attention today to something else. We'll get back to Paul when we close. But did you notice that when we read that reading today, how many people are mentioned? How many names there are? This group of people that are with Paul as he crosses the finish line. This group of people who ministered with him and who are approaching, they are as he approaches now the end. And the completion. I mean, it talks about Paul. Paul's the main character, but there's certainly Timothy. Because it's a letter to Timothy. There's Timothy, there's Demas, there's Crescens, there's Titus, Luke, Tychicus, Carpus, Alexander, and Mark. That's just in our short reading. If we continue through the fourth chapter, there's Onesiphorus, Priscilla, Aquila, Erastus, Trophimus, Eubulus, Pudens, Linus, and Claudia. Paul and about 18 other people named in chapter 4. And then we have groups of people that are not named. They're anonymous. And these are not only friends, but they are foes. They're not all good here. There's some bad eggs. And as we look at all these people and we look at how they finished, we note that some did not finish well. Not all crossed the finish line. Now, we can't talk about them all today, but I've divided them up very briefly into two groups. There are the faithful and the unfaithful. And the first is the faithful. Of course, there's Timothy. He is the faithful son. He's the one this is being written to. In 1 Corinthians 4:17, Paul calls him my son. He tells the Philippians, "I'm sending Timothy to you. He is my kindred spirit. He is just like me. He believes what I believe. He teaches what I teach." He's faithful. Faithful to the Lord. Faithful to the word. He is the one that's going to carry this thing through. Paul even says at the beginning of the letter that he thinks about Timothy day and night. He says, "You're in my prayers." He mentions his tears and Timothy's tears in this intimate relationship that they had. It's all going to be handed off to Timothy. And Timothy is finishing well. Timothy, because he's well-rooted, you see? He's well-rooted because it tells us in the beginning of the book, what about Timothy? What do we know about Timothy? Ah, from a child, your mother and grandmother taught you the scriptures. God bless the mothers and grandmothers who bring their children to church, who make their kids come to church, sometimes even. God bless them. Timothy is a faithful son. But after Timothy, we have somebody else. His name is Demas. And Demas is an unfaithful deserter. For Demas has deserted me, he says. Hurry up, Timothy, get here, because Demas has deserted. Now, it's an interesting verb, has deserted, because when we actually examine the verb, we see that it is a very intense word, and the meaning of it would be, Demas has left me in the lurch. Demas has left me in a dire situation. He's actually quit on the job. He's like the guy where you're out there and you're doing some work and you got to get this job done, and all of a sudden somebody quits that day. And there you are. What do you mean you quit now? I got to finish this. I got to do this. You can't quit right now. That's Demas. He quit right in the middle of it all. He was a deserter. And the thing about Demas is that he started well. He started out this thing very well. We don't know much about him, but we read about him in Colossians 4:14. We read about him in the book of Philemon. He's a fellow worker. He seems to be esteemed as in Paul's top group, you know, that help him, that minister with him, that do this work. Demas starts out well, but he doesn't finish well. Why? Because Demas loved this present world. Demas loved this present, the word is in the Greek, eon, right? We talk about eons and eons. That's the word. And it's the world, it means the world system, right? The world system. It means loving the world's aims and morals and opinions and values and impulses. John says, if any man loves the world, the love of the Father is not in him. Demas does not cross the line because of his pull. He has to, whatever it is, he has to go back to Thessalonica. Is it money? Is it career? Reputation? What is it? We don't know. It's the love of the world. And he leaves Paul in the lurch. He's an unfaithful deserter. But in the same sentence with Demas, the deserter, we have somebody else listed. And he and Demas are together again in Philemon. And we have this guy named Mark. And here's the interesting thing about Mark. Where Demas starts out well and doesn't finish well, Mark starts out and he messes it up at the beginning, but he finishes well. Mark, you know him. He wrote one of the Gospels. And you probably know the story that Paul and Barnabas are doing a missionary journey. Barnabas says, let me take my nephew Mark. He'll come with us. And they go on. They're traveling. And Mark backs out. Is he afraid? I don't know the reason. But Mark, he quits. He quits. And Paul and Barnabas have it out. Paul's angry. He doesn't want a quitter, right? He doesn't want somebody that's not all in. And so Paul says, well, go ahead then. You can have them. You take them. Silas and I are going somewhere else. And so they divide. But here's the thing about Mark. He came back. We know that Mark got on the right path again. Paul says here at the end, at the finish line, bring Mark. He's useful to me. I need him. He's back on track. And you see, That's the thing about a finish, right? You get off track or you have bumps in the road, but it's possible to come back. Jesus tells the story of the two prayers, of the two men. And one has an outside religion, but nothing inside. The other one has it inside. And he says, God, be merciful to me. I'm a sinner. I'm wrong. I've been wrong. Please help me. Please get me back on here. Forgive me. I was wrong. And Mark is a guy who doesn't start strong, but he has a strong finish. We know Luke. There's a lot to say about Luke. We'll just let him go for now. Titus. Now, who's Titus? Titus is one of the faithful. He's one of the faithful that are known, that are popular. You know, his name is mentioned 13 times in the New Testament. There's a letter, as you know, written to him in the New Testament. And it seems to be that the way this worked was that Paul would go into a community and he would preach the gospel. He would go to Crete. He would go to these different cities. And he would tell them the gospel and people would follow Christ. And then Paul would leave and Titus would come in and he'd get the whole thing up and running. He'd organize it. He'd get pastors and teachers and a church going and a system going. And Titus was the guy, the equipper, the leader. And he's known, okay? He's well known. He's faithful and he's well known. But who in the world is this other guy mentioned with him? Crescens. Ever hear of Crescens? I never did, really. I've actually glossed over a lot of these names in my reading of this text. But there's Crescens in verse 10. And this is the only mention of him. We know nothing about him except that he too was faithful. He too was someone that Paul entrusted to go to Galatia and work there. But he is a faithful unknown. Where Titus is known, Crescens, for all accounts, seems to be among the unknown. And there are many of them, aren't there, in Christianity? There are many in the church. There are many here. Nobody knows what you do. You quietly do your ministry, whether it's praying at home or what you're doing or the various ministries here. You're here and nobody sees you. Nobody else is here. Maybe nobody sees you at home ironing those altar cloths, right? Whatever it is, the faithful unknown. That's who Crescens represents. They finish well. Then there's Tychicus. Now he is faithful also. Tychicus is a faithful messenger. He's a traveler. He's a mover. He's the guy that takes the word of God. He has the parchments. He has the scriptures. And it's Tychicus that's taken him to all these places. Paul's letters. He's delivering the scriptures. Wow, he's a faithful messenger. He's on the move, but then you also have Carpus. And we don't know Carpus. Never hear about Carpus. I never have. Never preached about Carpus. Who is this guy? He's a faithful stayer. He's a stayer. He's not out there traveling and moving and shaking things up. He's there in Troas. Paul says, you stop there because he's keeping the stuff. He has my cloak. He has my parchments. He has the other books. The stuff that we need. He's faithful. He stays home. He stays there at the church. He's not big and it's not glamorous. But Carpus is a faithful stayer. All these finish well, don't they? All these cross the line. Known, unknown, goers, stayers. There's Alexander the coppersmith, the faithless enemy, whose day will come. We know about Alexander. He's an enemy of the gospel. He's fierce. Watch out for him, Paul tells Timothy. But we already see the finish line for him. We see the ending for Alexander. And it isn't good for the faithless. God The Lord, Paul says, will repay him. His day is coming. His day is coming. That's his ending. And then we have a group in verse 16. They would be called the unfaithful anonymous. They're not named, but they're certainly not given in a good light. The unfaithful anonymous. You see, when Paul was called into the trial, many believe that it was this way, that in Rome, there was a large basilica. It was a grand structure. At one end is a nave, at the other is the tribune, and it's this long hallway, and then it's shaped in the cross, and in the middle is the tribunal, a large ivory chair where the king would sit, where the judge would sit, where Nero probably sat to judge the defendant. And in the galleries are all, this was big stuff, these hearings. I mean, they weren't home watching cable, right, because they didn't have it. So what else are you going to do for fun in Rome? There's a trial, and let's go see what's happening. So all the people are filled in the galleries. And all of the dignitaries and the rich people have great seats and they're lined up. And so you had this enormous Roman basilica and structure, and in comes the defendant in front of the king, in front of the seat of judgment. And he's supposed to have witnesses. He was given the opportunity in Roman law that to have witnesses, to have a defense. And Paul says, none of them stood by me. I was alone. Why? Why weren't they there? What were they? Were they afraid of Nero? Were they afraid of persecution? Were they afraid of losing their business? What was it? We don't know. They were somehow afraid, weak of heart, and they can't cross the line. They don't make it. They don't finish well. But Paul says, the Lord stood with me. The Lord stood with me. He was there. And ultimately, that's how you cross, right? That's how you finish well. That's how you're able to fight the fight, run the race. Because no matter what happens, as in the case of Moses, when all turned against him, Joshua, and many of the great men and women of the Bible, when all is against them, and Paul said, I stood there in that great Roman structure, all that I've done for those people, all that I've given, and no one stood with me. No one defended me. Nobody spoke up. But the Lord stood with me.